Hey teachers, welcome back to the Literacy Lounge. I'm super excited for our episode today because I have a special guest that you are just going to fall in love with. I know a question I get asked a lot as an instructional coach is, you know, I'm a general education teacher. I don't have the background of special education, but yet I have students with special needs in my classroom. How can I best support them? And that is a very big umbrella question, which we could talk about in an entirely separate podcast all on its own. So we're really only going to be skimming the surface today, but it is a fantastic conversation that you're not going to want to miss. And it's a conversation not just with me, but we do have a special guest. She is an expert in her field, and her name is Dr. Chris Reeves. You may know her from the Autism Classroom Resources. And I cannot wait to introduce her and to let you hear what we have in store for you today. So let's head on in to the Literacy Lounge.
Teaching skills like reading comprehension doesn't have to be overwhelming. With the right tools and strategies in place, you can find success for you and your students. Step into the Literacy Lounge, the podcast that will give you the what, why, and how to elevate your literacy instruction and get the results you've always wanted. Here's your host and veteran elementary school teacher, Sierra Harris.
From running autism classroom resources to creating teacher resources on TPT, Dr. Reeves' driving goal has always been about bringing special educators together and helping them serve their students in the best ways they can. Chris has a doctorate in psychology and is a board-certified behavior analysis doctoral. She has spent the last 25 years working with a wide variety of special education programs as a behavior specialist, an administrator, a university faculty, and primarily as a trainer and a consultant. Chris runs Autism Classroom Resources Store on Teachers Pay Teachers, the Autism Classroom Resources podcast and blog, and also has a training and support membership site for special education teachers called the Special Educator Academy. Let's welcome in Dr. Chris Reeve. Hi, Chris. Welcome inside the Literacy Lounge.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here.
Yeah, this is definitely going to be a great chat. And I think teachers out there listening are really going to enjoy what we have in store for them. So when it comes to teaching, I was planning out my episodes and trying to figure out, what do we want to talk about? What kind of guests do I want to have on the show? I really started to think about what all the things that teachers need to juggle, all the things that teachers need and have on their plates. And honestly, at the top of that list, of course, is ensuring that all of our students, especially with those with special needs, have adequate access and get really the education that they deserve. And so I wanted to bring on someone who really could talk to us about supporting their students that have special needs inside more of a general education classroom. Because I know, I think about myself when I was in the classroom, I didn't have that special education background, but I had many students who had 504s and IEPs. And I really did struggle for many years figuring out how in the world to best support them. So I wanted to bring someone on, and then I found you, and I thought this was perfect. So I'm so glad you're here. So before we get into the nitty gritty, why don't you just take a quick second, tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your educational background, professional journey, and how you got into this area.
Sure. I actually always knew I wanted to work with students with special needs. I have an older sister who very clearly now it's clear that what she has is autism, but back in the 1950s, they didn't know what it was, who went through all regular education. And so I thought about doing a lot of different things when I was in college, and I just kept coming back to working with students with challenging behaviors and who had special needs. And so I was lucky enough to work at what is now Stony Brook University, which is a State University of New York on Long Island, and with Dr. Ted Carr working on the connection between severe challenging behavior and communication disorders, and really looking at how do we help. It was really the beginning of the positive behavioral support movement, of the idea that we could use teaching strategies to change behavior. And so I started doing that, I worked with all different ages. I've run a program for students with severe behavior and autism. I've overseen the behavioral staff of a program across a preschool and elementary program. And I worked at a university for about 14 years, providing consultation and training to school systems. And so that turned out to be the thing I absolutely loved the most, which is being able to work with teachers figuring out how to help their students. And that to me has really been the thing that I enjoy the most. So when my job became more academic, where I was creating master's and doctoral programs and ABA and autism, that was not really what I wanted to spend my time doing. So I went out on my own and continued to provide support in the classroom. And I now do that online through my TPT store, as well as through my Special Educator Academy, really trying to help give the tools that teachers need to support all different kinds of students.
That's amazing. You have such an enormous resume. It's very impressive. Is Stony Brook University, is that where you got your doctorate?
Yes.
Yeah? Yes. Awesome. I'm going through a doctorate program right now through St. John's University, which is in New York City as well. I think it's based in Queens, if I remember correctly, but I'm really excited. I just started, I'm in my second semester, so I've got a ways to go, but it's been really an awesome program so far. So, well, awesome. So clearly you have a lot to share with us today. So we'll only get into the nitty gritty a little bit. So I'll make sure that before we're done chatting, that I make sure that the listeners know where they can reach you, your website and stuff, and all that stuff will be, all those links will be in the show notes. So listeners can click and go and find you if they want more from you. So let's just start with the basics. What are some common challenges that special education students face when they're in like the general ed classroom, a more regular literacy block, and how can general education teachers address them effectively?
I think there's really three areas that I think of when I think of this. One is the accommodations for helping our students with the struggles they have with the language, with the academics, and it's particularly how the language disabilities might impact their reading and literacy. Because I think sometimes we forget that there's really that connection that's so important. And so I think that's probably the one that people think of the most. But for some of our students with special ed needs, we're looking at problems with social interaction. Our classrooms and our literacy blocks are very social kinds of places. We do a lot of collaborative groups and participating in groups. And that can sometimes be frustrating or problematic for students that have social interaction needs and needs for support. And another is just behavior and really working on keeping students engaged. Some of our students are coming from situations where they really need more support than we typically have in a general ed classroom. And we really have to think about how do we keep them engaged and what is the reason that we kind of want them there? Why are they there and what is their focus? And that's always the question I come back to as I think about addressing any of the challenges is, what is the goal of them being in this literacy block? What is the goal of them being here? For some of our students, it is a social interaction goal. For some of our students, it's a participation goal. For some of our students, it's the curriculum that's being taught. And so that then should lead us to figure out how we can support them if we're clear and we make sure that everybody working with the student is clear on what it is that we're trying to get out of this.
I think that is so important to remember because it really allows the teacher to let some things go. And I think as teachers, that's really hard to do. We think we want everything, all of our expectations for all of our students, right? But if we have students who do have identified special needs and they have specific goals, it's okay to be like you said, you're here for a social, you have a social goal. We're going to focus on that. And it's okay if some of the academics can slide by. We'll pick those up later. This is our focus right now. And so that almost gives us as teachers permission to be like I said, let some things go and not have some of that stress on our shoulders. And so making sure that teachers know what the goals are for our students and then what those supports look like really can almost relieve some stress that I think teachers face when they have students with special needs in their classrooms.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So in your experience, when we think about having not just students with special needs, honestly, because all of our students, I believe, have special needs. We're all individuals. They are all individuals who have different goals, different things that they're good at, and where areas that they need improvement in. So when we say the D word, differentiation, that really is something that should be all-encompassing. All students should experience. But what role do you think differentiation plays when it comes to supporting the diverse needs of our special education students inside, for example, a literacy block?
I think that exactly what you said, that it's recognizing that we want to embrace neurodiversity. So we want to recognize that everyone learns differently and everyone needs different things. And our students with special ed may need more support or more structured support than some of our other students. But in reality, most teachers are differentiating their instruction, perhaps not quite as deeply as they are when they have a special ed student, but they're understanding that this student does better when he reads something and this student does better when they hear something. And so they're using different strategies within their classroom to capture all of those learning needs. But obviously for our students with special needs, it means really adjusting supports. It means adjusting assignments and using some tools that maybe we wouldn't always use in a classroom to meet their individual needs. So for instance, you may have a student who needs help participating in the group or learning in a collaborative group, who needs you to structure that collaborative group a little bit more to help them understand that maybe they're not always the leader. I've had students on the spectrum, on the autism spectrum, who it's like, but I know more about the subject than everybody, so I should always be the leader. And it's like, yeah, that's not really going to fly in a collaborative group. And collaborative groups are important, and I don't want our students to miss them because they lay the foundation for us doing jobs. When I was teaching graduate students, they would always say, do we have to do a group assignment? I don't like group assignments. I'm like, I know no one likes groups assignments. But the reality is that our classrooms are very collaborative. Our schools are very collaborative. All our jobs are very collaborative. And those are the things that really are a lot of our students struggle with when they leave school. Another student may need assistance in understanding the abstract language of what's being taught, or what's being read. So they may need somebody to help them break down the topic or what the words mean. Another may need alternative ways of participation or responding. So you may have some students who have communication devices that they use, but it may also be something where a student needs to learn how to raise their hand and wait, or understanding when they should raise their hand and when they should call out. Or maybe they just don't do well with choral responding, and we need a way for them to participate in a way that isn't just yelling out the answer. And then another may need actual modifications to the curriculum to make it more accessible. So I think really making sure that teachers have a variety of tools at their disposal, and the collaboration between special educators, the language pathologists, and the general educators is really key. And I think that's probably one of the hardest pieces because just of the time that it takes. But I think it's one of the real keys of really understanding what a student needs in order for this to be a functional time for them.
Yeah, I agree, especially with the communication part. It's so hard to get everyone on the same playing field. And it's not that they don't want to collaborate, it's they don't have the time and sometimes the resources to be able to do that. But I see differentiation almost in like two different aspects. I see it as I'm differentiating for the entire class. I've got my students who are higher on level and below level, whether they have an IEP or not, and how am I going to support them with this specific objective, this standard? But then you have your individual differentiation. Those are more of like your scaffolds, your accommodations. And that's where it goes back to what we just talked about before, knowing your goals. So mm-hmm. I'm not going to give a student who has a social goal an accommodation or scaffold that doesn't align to that. I'm not going to differentiate something for them that doesn't align to their goal. So it all goes together. So it just, there's almost, I'm a very visual person. So I almost see it as like a different, like a ladder
layers.
Or yeah, different layers of differentiation. And so you've got your whole group differentiation where you're differentiating for everyone, but then differentiating for your individual needs as well.
Yeah.
So thinking about supporting our teachers, because everyone out there listening is like, this is great. How do I make this happen? So how can educators really start to create a more supportive and inclusive learning environment for not just all their students, but specifically their special education students within their classroom?
I think one way is what we just talked about a few minutes ago of embracing neurodiversity and the idea that everybody learns differently. Mm-hmm. And I think really making sure that everybody's got a good understanding of, if you have a student coming in who has a disability, how do we talk about that? How do we discuss he needs something different than the rest of the class? I run into a lot of pushback sometimes from, not always from teachers, sometimes from paraprofessionals, of, well, the other kids are going to see that he gets to do this, and they're going to think, and I'm like, well, life's not fair, and the world doesn't work on an even playing field. And what we're trying to do is even the playing field, and teach students that different people need different things. It becomes a lesson for the whole class. And it's about also really knowing how much you can share, how much a child wants shared about their disability or their needs, and how much families want that. But also understanding that I do a lot of lessons with kids of, everybody's different. Everybody has different needs. So I wear glasses. Here, you want my glasses? Because apparently, if everybody does the same thing, you should be wearing glasses. And if they put my glasses on, they're never going to be able to see. And so I think that that is a piece of making that supportive, inclusive learning environment, is being comfortable with the idea that everybody doesn't do the same thing, that everybody doesn't get the same supports, everybody doesn't have the same needs, and helping the students to understand that and not giving into that, but that's not fair. It's like, no, this, let's talk about what's fair. You have a Band-Aid because you fell down. Does everybody need a Band-Aid? And really doing some of that prep work as well. That has nothing to do, I realize, with literacy direction of construction.
Oh, no, it's absolutely imperative. You're building that foundation for what comes later to be able to work.
Yeah, exactly. I think it also goes back to that same question about understanding what the goals are for the participation. So, and recognizing that for some of those accommodations and modifications, we might be adjusting time that they spend in the activity. Maybe every student doesn't need to stay in the literacy activity for the same amount of time. I have students who come in and spend 5 minutes, and that's what they can handle right now. We'll work up to more, but I want that time to be successful for them, and I want it to be successful for the rest of the classroom as well. It might include training other peers to help the student participate, understanding when they should help and when they shouldn't help, and recognizing who are those good peers to help and who are the ones that might get the kid in trouble, but really helping them to learn how to help in a way that either isn't overtaking them or just staring at them. And I think, I guess what I'm saying is, it's not all about how we present the instruction. Mm-hmm. I think there are things that we can do for instruction. We can talk about those. But I also think that really to create that environment, it's a lot about how we prepare the other students, how we set up the classroom, how we know, if I know that having the student sit in the same place every time is going to relieve his anxiety, that's what I'm going to set up the class to do. That'll be his designated spot. As opposed to, well, everybody just sits where they want, but this is going to help him be successful. So it's really allowing some of that, those changes, and recognizing that everybody needs it to some degree as well.
Yeah. And I love, honestly, that you didn't jump right into instructional strategies and this and that, because sometimes it's really just important to take a step back and say, have I done this? Is this something that is a barrier that's in my way that I haven't taken the time to create this culture in my classroom of acceptance and support and identity to be able to allow my future strategies to be more successful? Because doesn't matter what those are, if this foundation is not in place, then it doesn't matter what we do later. It's not going to work. And I also say too, teachers ask me all the time, I've got special education students, how can I best support them? Like, that's just a question that's asked always. And I always think back to when I was teaching, like what could I or should I have done differently when I was in the classroom to support my own students? And it comes down to something that I'm going to say it and we're all going to cringe and it's going to be okay. But I never read their IEPs. I know, I can see your face. It's crazy, right? Probably not for 8 years straight. No one told me to read their IEPs. No one told me where they were. No one sat down and taught me how to read an IEP. Like, this was something that maybe was in a college course that was skipped over pretty quickly. Or I'd
like to say I'm surprised, but I'm not.
You're not. No, definitely. I would be shocked if teachers out there are like, oh yeah, I totally had a great class that taught me how to read IEP. No, that's not a thing. Or if it is, it's very rare. But honestly, that's step one, right? Like, get the IEP out. Sit down if you can with your special education teacher and supports that you have there. If you don't understand what the IEP is saying, make sure to educate yourself. You are not going to be able to understand their goals, understand their accommodations. None of that's going to be in place unless you read the legal document. So I know teachers, they like to, and I did this later on when I started to actually read the IEPs, I would create like an IEP at a glance document that I would keep on me. That way I didn't have to have that legal document on me at all times to refer back to. I would take notes and then that would be something that I would refer back to. But I think both of those things really go hand in hand. What you said about building that culture, but then also taking the time and the initiative to read the IEP and get to know that student. And then you can start to see success in a lot of the accommodations and the scaffolds and the differentiation that you put in place later on.
Yeah. And I think that's really key. And again, I'm not surprised. I've had special ed teachers who tell me the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, my thought is always, if I'm a family member sending my child with special needs to school, am I going to feel more comfortable with somebody who walks in? And maybe the information isn't all completely accurate. It's the beginning of school. We've been through the summer, but I'm going to be a lot more comfortable with somebody who says, well, I've got the things that I know he likes to do, and I know that these are the things we're going to work on this year, than I am for somebody who goes, oh, is this your child? Tell me about them. And it's like, why did we sit through that IEP meeting if this is like where we're at now? And so I think that that's really, really key. And I've actually got a couple kind of shorthand IEP strategies that I'll share, because I think that they're really useful for mapping out and understanding what we're focusing on at different times. Mm. But yeah, you have to know the student. And I'm a big one on collaboration. It's been that way my whole life. And there's a great quote that's something like, the student is the priority, changes the reality. Collaboration is the way we make this work.
I love that.
And that's a really bad version of it. But it really just defines who I am. It's all about the student. And as long as we keep the student at the center of the conversation, then we're going to stay on track. Whether we're in an IEP, whether we're thinking about their needs, whether we're trying to plan for their instruction, whatever it is, as long as we're focused on that, that keeps our collaboration on track as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important to remember that. It's not about the curriculum. It's not about the standards, right? It's not about the strategies that we're using. It's about the student. And I love that. So we haven't gotten into instructional tools yet because I love what we've been talking about, but I know teachers are going to want to know. So what are some recommended instructional tools or resources that really can enhance learning for your special education students?
I think one of the things that is most helpful for the students who have the language issues are the graphic organizers. I think any kind of graphic organizer that helps them break down the topics, what they're reading, all those kinds of things are really critical. I think, obviously, there's a ton of different ones you can use, and most people are pretty familiar with them, but it's not a high-tech tool, but it really helps, especially students that are very visual. So a student with autism, for instance, whose visual skills are probably stronger than his auditory skills, it's going to make more sense to him if he could see it. And we can move and we can have goals where we move the student from, I present him with a graphic organizer that's already filled out, to filling his own out and being able to break what he's reading down. But I find that to be the best set of tools for students who have those language issues. I think for the students that have problems with group instruction or students who have a hard time participating, one of the things I use a lot are response cards. And I think response cards are good for all classrooms, whether they're special ed or general ed, for a lot of reasons. And response cards, for anyone who's not familiar with them, are anything from a particular picture or card that you hold up to answer a question, or if you're doing tell me what this word is, they're writing it down on a dry erase board and holding it up so everybody can, so the teacher can see it. And I think one of the things that it does is it works really well for our students with attention deficit disorder and those attentional kinds of issues, because they're not good at waiting for everybody to, well, that person has a turn and that has a turn. And they just zone out during that time. So they're missing that instruction. Like, we're assuming that our kids are getting that instruction while one student is responding. But really, for some of our kids, they just blanked out during that time. And so response cards are something that you can ask a question and everybody answers every time. So they're getting more practice in the skill. You don't have to worry about turn taking and things like that. And the teacher can easily look across the room and assess who's got it and who doesn't, which can then inform their instruction to know who do I need to give more help with this concept and who do I not need to worry about. And I think those kinds of things, the fact that it also keeps our students from having to wait silently, is sometimes a really good help as well. And again, they could be a circle, thumbs up, thumbs down. They can do multiple choice A, B, C, D. I do them when I do training with teachers. I put an ABCD up and I give them a piece of paper that they fold into quarters and they have to hold it up and they all look at me and I'm like, no, but this way I see who's getting it, as opposed to I get one person who answers and it's like, no, you're just like your kids. And so I think those are probably the two of the instructional strategies that I use the most as far as tools are concerned. I think one of the things that I use a lot, and this kind of gets into the collaboration piece, and it goes back to what you were talking about with the IEP at a glance. There's two documents. One is a teaching implementation plan, which is something that I created for teachers I was working with, that takes a student's IEP and plans out where are we teaching each individual objective on their IEP? What activity lends itself best for this? What strategy are we going to use to teach this skill? How are we going to assess it and take data on it? And how are we going to generalize it to other things? So how are we going to build it into something else beyond just that skill? And I find that to be a really useful tool for students that are in significant resource classrooms or students who need a lot more support, because I actually create the classroom schedule based on the goals of the students. Having done that, it's real easy for me to go back and go, oh, I'm going to need this many kids doing this activity because this many goals are going to go with that. And it makes sure that every IEP goal and objective is laid out into the classroom day. Another thing that you can use, and I'll send you links to both of these to put in the show notes, is something that was created by Brenda Smith Miles and Sean, I've forgotten his last name, but they have a book about it and it's called the Comprehensive Autism Planning System. It is not just for students with autism. I use it for all different kinds of students. And it looks at the teacher, the general ed teacher schedule, or anybody's teaching schedule of the day, and identifies what goals and objectives are going to be addressed during that time of day. So mine's kind of a bottom-up approach. Theirs is kind of a top-down. General ed teachers have their schedule set. We have to figure out how our students are going to fit into that schedule most effectively. And it takes you through some of the same things. It looks also at some sensory supports and some reinforcer kinds of supports that I think can be really useful. Both of them, I think, are really useful for collaboration documents between the teacher and the general ed teacher, as well as with the parents. And if you have a paraprofessional who is supporting a student only for, say, one activity, you can actually cut it apart if they're supporting multiple students and give them just the pieces for those students so they can see. It also has accommodations that are allowed, what modifications are allowed. And that means that they're not standing there going, you just gave him a whole worksheet and he's like freaking out. What do? They know I can cut it apart. I could draw lines on it. I can do something like that as a strategy. And that's allowed in his IEP. Or I could simplify it, or I could read it to him, or whatever it is. And I think that that becomes really useful so that everybody's on the same page about, again, what we're addressing, but also how we can address it and what makes the most sense. So I find those to be really useful tools for those collaborative types of planning.
Yeah, I love that you not only gave us some strategies, and I will say that I am a huge proponent of TPT. And when I say TPT, I do not mean teachers pay teachers, total participation techniques, where 100% of your students are participating in the lesson. Yes. And it is so important to walk away and say, was Johnny able to showcase his knowledge of that objective today? Was Susie, like, if you cannot walk away from that lesson and say 100% of your students did not participate in the lesson, then you just completely wasted those students' time. Like, they may have gotten something out of it, but you don't know because you didn't see their participation. So I love that you gave some of those examples because that's like right up my alley. I love that. And then what I talked about earlier, the IEP at a glance, I love that you've taken it like to this next level. I never thought about the goals relating to certain times of the day and like actually taking that IEP and immediately having activities or strategies like right connected to their goals, because that takes, honestly, like that's the hardest part. Like I can take this IEP and I can see their goal. Okay, they have a goal of whatever it may be, whether it's behavioral or academic, but how do I do this? What do I do with this student to help them reach this goal? So having that piece of paper that you can create that has all this on it, it's easy for me to have those out. I'm planning out my lessons. Let me make sure everyone's IEPs are covered. All right, we're good. Let's go. So I absolutely love that. And that kind of lends itself into the next question that I was going to ask about collaborating between special education teachers and general education teachers. We address this at the beginning that time is such a huge issue, but how can we really support and find more effective collaboration practices to really bring both worlds together to support those students?
And that's a really huge question because I think it's one of the questions. I was just doing some planning with a district the other day for some training I'm doing for a school. And we were training exactly on what you were talking about. How do the teachers take those goals and turn them into instructional strategies and lead us to where the students are going to go when they leave school? And that's really the focus. And one of the team members was like, and if you have a moment in the training, could you talk about how to collaborate with each other about the student's education and how we can make the collaborative team really work? I'm like, that's a whole other day of training. I will do my best, but that is not part of what we're talking about here. But it is such a need because it is a really hard thing to do. And unfortunately, it's something I think that collaborative planning is really important. I think the special education teacher and the general education teacher talking to each other, I think speech and language pathologist should be involved for students with language issues working in literacy. But that is a time-consuming process. And the one thing that we are extremely short of, in addition to staff in classrooms these days, is time. And so I like using the tip and the cap as a way for just general, everybody's on the same page about what we're doing here. We've highlighted the literacy block. This is what we're working on for this student. Here's the accommodations that he can have. Here's the modifications he needs to the curriculum. But I think for collaborative planning, some of the ways that we can shorten it are to really try to share lesson plans. I know in a lot of schools, lesson plans get a really bad rap. I'm a big fan of lesson plans because I think they really allow you to plan out your instruction. And yes, there will be times that you go, well, next week's lesson plan doesn't work because we haven't finished this week's lesson plan. And that's okay. You can go through and make changes to it. I have a lot of special ed teachers who tell me, well, I don't need lesson plans. I have a schedule. I'm like, that's a schedule. That's not a lesson plan. And granted, and many times there's not a lot of things we have to change on our lesson plans because a lot of our objectives stay the same or we're moving through a curriculum and things like that. But I think that the more that the general ed teacher can share lesson plans with the special educator so that they can maybe even prepare a student. One of the strategies I like to use is to have some of our students who aren't there maybe for the academics in the literacy block, maybe we review the materials in resource to prepare them for that. Or maybe we review their behavior and their social preparation before they walk in the door so that they're ready. I used to have a kid that was going into third grade, and by the time he got across the school into their room, he was completely dysregulated. Mm-hmm. And so he would get to the door outside his third grade class, and we would go through this series of relaxation strategies, and we would read a social story, and then we would take some deep breaths, and then we would go, okay, now we're ready to go in, as opposed to walking into class and disrupting the entire activity because he was just completely dysregulated. So I think that the more that they know about what the student's going to be doing when they come to the regular ed class, the more that they can begin to prepare them for those activities, whether it's behaviorally and socially, or preparing, maybe they're pre-teaching some of the materials. I've had students that it's like, you know what, they're there for participation. I'll teach the activities. Sometimes in resource classroom, if the students are getting resource time, maybe the bulk of the academic piece gets taught in the resource class so the student can perform in the general ed class because they may need more time with it. And so I think those conversations are important. So some of the things that I think can help with that are highlighting the areas maybe on a lesson plan that the gen ed teacher thinks they're going to need the most help with, or that the student's going to need the most help with, and just giving kind of a highlight. One thing that's worked for some teachers I've worked with is having a running Google Doc or shared document of some kind of observations and thoughts that they can add on the go and share with them of, wow, thought that was going to be great. That did not work. We need to rethink this for next time. Because it's hard to remember that when you finally have the time to sit down and talk. I think having special education teachers in the grade level meetings can be helpful. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on how the grade level meetings are structured and what their role is. I have a lot of teachers who have students that are in general ed for very little of the time, and they're not there for academics. For them, I'm not sure it makes as much sense, but for people who are supporting the students in the general ed class, it can definitely be helpful if they're there to say, but hey, what if we added in response cards, or do we have a graphic organizer for what we're planning to do here? And I think that can help as well, just because that is time that seems to still exist within our daily classroom time, within our classroom day, classroom week, whatever. So I think really being inventive of how do we share that information. When I need to track behavior, for instance, I use a Google Doc with just write down your rating scale and any notes that you want to share with me, just stick it in the Google Doc and I'll review it at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So I can see what his day looked like because I wasn't with him the whole day. So,
yeah. Honestly, what I take from that is we can all say and sit in meetings and say, you know, I want to be more collaborative with my special education team, but you have to be intentional about it. You actually have to do it. So I think it's just so important to start your year with communicating with them and say, how are we going to communicate? I think that's like the biggest thing. Are we going to have a weekly meeting between the two of us where we maybe have lunch together and we sit and we talk about whatever we need to talk about versus our caseload? Or are we going to have an after school meeting and go for coffee or something? Like, it doesn't, you just get creative with it, but have a conversation about how are we communicating?
I'm so glad you said that. let me add something to that,
because
this is something I forgot, which is that I think really identifying who is doing what is a really important piece of that.
Oh, yeah.
Recognizing who is making any kind of material accommodations or material modifications to the material that the student is using. Is that the general ed teacher? Is that the special ed teacher? Where does it fit in? Are they doing it together in a collaborative planning meeting? Is it something they're expecting the para to do? Another one is who's supervising the para? And mm-hmm. generally, it's the general ed teacher when they're in their class and the special ed teacher when they're in their class. But there needs to be collaboration there, too, because the paraprofessionals will get very confused when they're getting completely different messages from two different people. And then they're never going to make either one of them happy and the student's not going to be successful. So yeah. Really sitting down and mapping out who is going to do all the different things that need to be done to support these students. Who is responsible for them, and dividing that up so that we're clear and we walk away from a collaborative meeting knowing I'm going to do this, you're going to do this. So by this time, we should have everything together. And I think that that's really key. I think you're exactly right.
Yeah. And honestly, I reflect back on the schools that I worked at, and I can sadly say that many of the schools I've been in, it was two different worlds happening. The teacher would be teaching something, and the special education teacher, when that student was in their class, they were teaching something completely different. And they may still be using like differentiation and scaffolding techniques and strategies, whatever, to help with those lessons, but those lessons did not support each other. It was like two things were happening at once, and that's not going to really get that student where they need to be for the goals that they have. So I think when you're talking with that teacher at the beginning of the year, you're figuring out how you're going to communicate, what roles does everyone have? The other part of that needs to be, how is our teaching going to support each other for this one student, for these two students, or whatever it may be? Like, how is my teaching to support yours? How does yours to support mine? Like you said, like, we're highlighting things, we're pre-teaching before they come to my classroom where I'm doing the bigger portion of the teaching or whatever it may be. And this is something that I preach, and I promise I will not go off on a tangent, but tier one instruction is so important for tier two and tier three to happen effectively. So yes, those students, unless they are in more of a severe...
In a self-contained class?
Thank you. Thank you. I was like, what is that called? That's a whole different ballgame, right? But yeah, if you have a student who they have 30 minutes of tier three with a special education student, but they're still in your 90-minute reading block, which mm-hmm. they should be, then that tier one instruction of grade level instruction is extremely important. Even if like it's going to be academically over their heads, they still need it in order for the support that they get in tier two and tier three to work. So you've got to figure out, how does my teaching support yours? How does yours just support mine? What does it look like in one picture? My room and your room cannot be islands. We have to talk to each other. So
that's right.
I don't think that was too much of a tangent, was it?
I would have gone off on the same tangent. So it doesn't bother me.
I can't stand it. Like, when I hear that students leave the classroom during like the 90-minute block, I'm like, how are they getting grade level instruction? What are they mm-hmm. doing? Like, anyways. Mm-hmm. So. All right. So we know that we've got these students in our classrooms. And just like all students, we've got to make sure that they are growing and meeting the goals of their IEPs. So I know a question that a lot of teachers have is, really, how do I assess their progress towards their goals? So what strategies do you really recommend for our general education teachers for assessing the progress and the growth of these students? And how do you use data really to inform this?
I love data. I have
Me
to
too.
Like,
I'm a data nerd. That.
Yeah, I like data so much. I wrote a whole book about it because I think people make it harder than it has to be. I think data is critically important because it's the only way we can know students are making progress, and we don't want to find that out when we get to the end of the quarter and we go to write our progress record and go, oh, well, he didn't do very well. Mm-hmm. We want to correct that before we get to that point. So I think one of the things I do say is, whatever we're doing, we want to do it on a regular basis, but we don't need to take data on every single thing the student does, because that's going to get in the way of instruction.
Yeah.
And we always have to balance those two. If you're not doing any instruction, data doesn't really help you very much. So for students that are on grade level, I think the assessments are pretty much the same, but they're going to have the accommodations that they can have according to their IEP.
Yeah.
And so I would, once a week or however you're assessing the general ed class, give them those assessments with whatever types of supports they are allowed to have as part of that. I think for our other students, we're going to base our data and our assessment on the goals of why they come to literacy block. So what are their literacy goals that you are assessing? Maybe it's fluency. So maybe once a week, we do a quick test of that skill where we just do a quick reading, running, fluency running record and see if they're making progress. If they're not, then we're going to need to take more data. But if they're making data, then we can just keep going on at the same clip. I think behavior and interaction and participation, one of the things that I use a lot for those are either rating scales or rubrics. I really love rubrics. Obviously, we use them for a lot of literature kinds of base things as well, but we can do behavior rubrics and social rubrics where we're actually specifying what are the behaviors that we want to see. So if we have a student who has a social skills goal to interact with a peer, we may have a rubric that says he stands at appropriate distance from the student. He looks at their face. He makes a statement. He waits for a response. And we're checking off whether or not he did that and with what quality. Because I think one of the things about both social and behavior is a lot of times we're not just talking about quantity. We're talking about quality. We're talking about, yeah, I have a lot of kids. I used to have a kid who could go through an entire conversation with you without you saying anything. He would hold both sides of the conversation because he was just like, I'm checking it off of my list. I'm done. And that's great quantity, but it's not great quality. And so having a rubric where we're actually rating, was it excellent? Was it okay? Was it, you know, average? Was it something we still need to work on? Gives us an assessment that we can go back to each week and look at. And it's also something that I've used with general ed teachers as just a really quick way for them to take data when there's nobody else in their classroom to support them with it, which I think is a huge issue because we tend to think the data has to be time intensive. Kindergarten going into first grade, going in without any kind of support. And the teacher was like, I can't take all this data that you people take. And it's like, you don't have to, but we do have a goal we have to monitor for her. So we created a rubric for her and just said once a week, just watch her during this activity and rate her on the rubric. And we'll see if she needs us to come in and provide some more support or if she's doing okay. And that was really enough data for us to be able to determine if she was really meeting her goals or not. So it doesn't have to be overwhelming. It just has to be as consistent as we can make it.
Yeah, absolutely. You're setting these goals, and a lot of times those goals are SMART goals where there's going to be some type of percentage or number involved. You want those goals to be quantifiable. You want it to be black and white and
You want it to be objective.
Thank you. It's like, oh, that doesn't sound right in my brain. So that way you've got then the data, you're assessing it, and you're taking those frequent collections to see, is this goal actually working? Are we meeting the goal? Do we need to lower the goal? Do we need to expand the goal? Do we need to change the goal completely because they've met the goal? Like, and if we're not taking that data, then we have no evidence to support it. And we can't legally change the goal if we don't have the data to support it. So that's just one of the most important parts of this entire process. So yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, Chris, this was a fantastic conversation. And again, I know we skimmed the surface of everything when it comes to supporting special needs students. We could have a whole podcast on just that, right? But I think that teachers listening probably got a lot out of this. And I'm so thankful that you were able to take some time and join us inside the Literacy Lounge today. So thank you so much. And I will make sure to get your social media links, website, things like that, and any other links that we talked about today and put them in the show notes. That way, if you are listening now, you can scroll down and click right on those and reach out definitely to Chris if you have further questions. I'm sure she'd be happy to help you. And she's got a lot of great resources too to really help support you with your students. So thanks again. And this was fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. So
I could tell you were very, very passionate about it. I loved every minute. All right. Thanks, teachers. We'll see you over in the next episode.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Literacy Lounge with Sierra Harris. You can find any of the resources mentioned in the show notes at sierraharristeaching.com/podcast. If you're looking for more support with close reading, download the free close reading guidebook at www.buildingcomprehension.com/close-reading-guidebook. Until next time, happy reading!